And if he doesn't get elected, then, you know, we're looking at a very, you know, scary future for our country and our republic. I mean, if he gets elected, it's going to be still very messy, and he's still going to have to pardon himself, and they're going to try to, you know, destroy his legitimacy. And that's really what all this is, to destroy his legitimacy and destroy his election chances. USA,
home of the brave. Ladies and gentlemen, distinguished guests, and my fellow citizens, America's comeback starts right now.
From the land of the free and the brave, USA, I love my country, they can't take that away.
All righty, welcome back. Financial Guys Podcast here with Mike Sparazza in studio. Special guest today on our exclusive interview, Gavin Wax, president of the New York Young Republicans Club. Gavin, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's great to be here, Mike. Thanks for having me.
You have been all over the 2024 race, the Trump campaign, and, you know, I don't know what I was going to talk about today. I usually prep a lot, and then yesterday I texted you and said, well, we're going to be talking about the indictment today. Another indictment yesterday, four counts in D.C. for Donald Trump. First off, let's just take everything else out of it. What were your initial thoughts, and how do you feel after a night of sleep on this one?
Well, you know, nothing surprising. This is the swamp and the D.C. Uniparty going after the biggest threat to the system, and that is President Donald J. Trump. They wouldn't be doing this. They wouldn't be indicting him all over the country. They wouldn't be throwing the entire kitchen sink at him if they didn't think, one, not only he had a chance to get back into office in 2024, but also, two, that if he were to get back into office in 2024, he would pose a massive threat to the system. So they're basically showing how desperate and scared they are, which I think is a nice silver lining. And as far as the specifics of this indictment, it's another, you know, nonsensical, poorly constructed indictment from the incompetent, you know, Jack Smith, prosecutor Jack Smith. You know, he's, you know, stretching these untested legal theories to their breaking point. There is no crime. No laws were broken. And I have some confidence that Trump and his legal team will be able to get himself out of most of these indictments, or at least delay them until after the election is won, which I am, you know, praying and hoping for. But certainly this is an uphill fight. And this is really the primary contest we're facing right now. The primary contest in the primary, or even in the general, is not necessarily Trump v. DeSantis or one of these other you know, characters. It's Trump v. the DOJ. This is the primary fight in a multi-front war, and we'll have to see how this unfolds, but it's really testing not only the legal system, the judicial system, but our republic as a whole. And if we allow this to become precedent, if we allow the DOJ and these corrupt actors to weaponize the system against their political opponents, against the political opposition, we'll never be able to have a free election in this country. The republic will effectively be dead. So it's absolutely pathetic to see some establishment Republicans basically putting out these weak talking points, these pro-institutional talking points, claiming that, oh, you know, Trump will have a fair day in court. He's not going to have a fair day in court in a D.C. with a D.C. jury and a D.C. Obama-appointed judge. I mean, this is a politicized show trial, if there ever was one, and it just goes to show the depths in which we have fallen as a country.
So, yeah, that's one thing. I'm going to get to, like, people like McCarthy in a little bit, because I'm so sick and tired of the tweeting and the we're gonna do something, I promise you. And we haven't seen them do anything, so we'll get to that in a little bit. You know, you're, I believe, from New York like I am, so we've seen the first indictment here in New York, down in New York City with Alvin Bragg. Now, you also have the second indictment, and now this is the third indictment. Can you break down the indictment, this specific indictment, for our listeners a little bit on why you think it's a stretch? I agree with you, but I want to hear from someone like you.
I mean, we're supposed to accept that it's criminal to precisely follow the law. That's basically what this indictment is trying to claim, and it's completely ignoring, you know, the law that was laid out in the Electoral Count Act of 1887. There was no violations of the law. Trump was using all his lawful rights to legally challenge the results of the elections, and there are procedures that have been created in place for this very purpose, going back to the election of Samuel, the election featuring Samuel Tilden in 1876, I believe, where there was a contested election, and they created procedures in order to deal with competing slates of electors and all sorts of different things, and this has happened throughout the years. It happened, I believe, in the 1960 election with JFK and Nixon. I mean, this is not an uncommon thing, and we've even seen recently, as early as, you know, the elections between Bush Gore and Bush Kerry that Democrats routinely objected to slates of electors. So none of this has ever been a crime or thought of as a crime. There were no co-conspirators or anything like that. They weren't defrauding anybody because there was never actually any criminal intent, which is, you know, the basis of this. And again, the indictment is extremely weak, and the indictment is basically just a politicized witch hunt of the president, and it's trying to criminalize asking questions. It's trying to criminalize legitimate channels to express concern with the elections, concern with election results, and to examine the legitimacy of elections, which is a healthy part of the system. And we have procedures legally for challengers and different candidates at the federal, all the way down to the local level to do that. So none of this was actually a crime. And I think that needs to be, you know, front and center. And they're basically trying to interpret the Constitution as some sort of living document that they can come up with crimes on a whim, that Jack Smith can determine what a crime is and what a crime is not. So this indictment is nonsense, these four counts. But look, at the end of the day, we know he's not going to get a fair and free go at this in D.C. with this Obama-appointed judge who has, you know, issued sentences for, say, the January 6th defendants beyond what the prosecutors have been asking for. She's clearly another politicized, individual, just like Jack Smith has himself. And I think the best course of action here would be for Trump to find a way, well, one, to do a motion to dismiss, and this is something that Darren Beatty has talked about, to do a motion to dismiss. Obviously, the judge in this case will reject it, and then, you know, request from the Supreme Court something called certiorari before judgment. It's a complicated Latin word. But basically, it gets to leapfrog to the Supreme Court, and they can overrule the decision of this lower district court. I think that's his best line of attack here for this particular indictment. I have a lot more confidence in Judge Cannon in the documents case down in Florida and the jury pool down there. And I've already tweeted out, you know, that we shouldn't even have district court. I mean, we're kind of going off topic here. We shouldn't even have district courts in a place like Washington. It should just be, you know, rolled up into the District Court of Maryland and then into the Fourth Circuit, similar to how Alexandria and Arlington are now part of, you know, the Eastern District of Virginia, and they also roll up to the Fourth Circuit. You have these federal judges and courts in D.C., and it's just the swamp. It's the swamp judging their own and going after their enemies. That's all it is. You can't get a fair jury pool in a place that votes 90% for Democrats. It's simply not possible. So it's all just testing and pushing the system. It's exposing the flaws in the system. I think he has, you know, means and recourse here, and I certainly think it's going to be a race against time. Like I said, it's basically a timing issue here to push this as far back as possible, to exhaust all legal remedies, and then fight like hell to win back the White House come 2024. And if he needs to pardon himself, he'll have to do that.
Yeah, I think this one was crazy too. And they talked about this last night with Jack Smith, you know, the judge. But it's almost like telling Donald Trump he can't feel a certain way. And the fact that he feels a certain way, he's now getting indicted. He felt it was fraudulent. Now they're going to try and prove that he shouldn't have felt that way. It just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I guess my question to
it's
you,
a thought
Gavin,
crime.
Is,
they're making it a thought crime that you can't
exactly
have your own views, your opinions, or have any, you know, sense of free speech to even express those views. I mean, it's criminalizing the thought. It's criminalizing the speech associated with the thought. I mean, this is very dangerous dystopian stuff, and it's basically trying to set into law, set into precedent that you can never have any type of recourse going forward with a contested election, with a close election, that if you even bring up anything that could be, construed as questioning the legitimacy of an election that may very well be illegitimate, you will be, you know, a criminal, and then you will be charged and prosecuted accordingly. So this is a very dangerous case in terms of the implications going forward as a country. But I cut you off. I apologize.
No. That's exactly where I was going with that. And my thing now is, so there's supposed to be another one, right? We're going to have another indictment, I'm assuming, before the end of the summer here with Georgia. At what point, Gavin, I mean, what happens here? If he gets convicted on one of these, New York City's possible for the same reason that D.C.'s possible, because look at the jury pool there probably, right? Then you have Georgia. Who knows what happens there? Florida looks better than the other ones. But what happens when he, if and when, and I believe they will get him on something because they will do anything they can to get him. What happens? Does he still run? Does he have issues? I mean, is he in jail? I mean, what happens here?
No, I think depending on what happens, I think he's going to definitely, beat a lot of these charges. I'm sure there may be something they get him on, you know, depending on the severity of it. I mean, I think it's very unlikely that he ever serves jail time. But again, I really think this is going to come down to him pardoning himself for some of these federal offenses and making sure that he remains on the ballot. I think really the name of the game here is to make sure that there's no shenanigans at the convention, that there's no shenanigans when it comes to what they can do to try to knock someone off who's been convicted of a crime. You know, I'm talking about the Republican side here, and making sure that he remains on the ballot in the 50 states. But I think they're certainly going to use whatever he ultimately ends up getting convicted on. I don't know, you cite the 14th Amendment, whatever, to go around and try to knock him off different states. But look, I think certainly he's going to probably get convicted on something, because I don't think he's going to be able to get a fair trial. Just that's the sad state of affairs in our country, and that's just really what it is. But ultimately, I think, you know, it's going to come down to if he gets elected and if he doesn't. And if he doesn't get elected, then, you know, we're looking at a very, you know, scary future for our country and our republic. I mean, if he gets elected, it's going to be still very messy, and he's still going to have to pardon himself, and they're going to try to, you know, destroy his legitimacy. And that's really what all this is, to destroy his legitimacy and destroy his election chances. I think him, you know, walking on any of these charges is only going to help him in the general. I think it's only going to validate his campaign further. We've seen that in the primary. But I think for the general, if he's able to prove his innocence in some of these, that, you know, he'll be able to move forward. I'm least concerned about the New York case. That's probably the weakest of them all, you know, basically trying to accuse him, you know, charging him with fraud and the furtherance of a crime, but they don't actually cite what the underlying crime is. I mean, that's probably the most hocus pocus of all of these indictments to date, the weakest by far. But look, there's no easy answers. There's no white pill here necessarily, not for everything in totality. They're throwing, like I said earlier, the entire kitchen sink at him and hoping to destroy his legitimacy, weaken and destroy his chances to come back into power. And I think, again, for people like myself and others who are Trump supporters, this only validates our support of him, because they realize that he is a true threat to the system, and they truly do believe that he has the best shot to win. And if you look at the polling, his polling has never been more robust in 16 or 20. He has the best polling he's ever had from his prior races. And even CNN and the New York Times are admitting this. So that's why they really are scared, and they view him as a threat, and they understand him coming back into power in 2024. He would not be making the same mistakes he made in 2016. He'll be coming in as someone who already had experience in the executive, who understands the people around him who he can trust, the people that are loyal, the people he could promote in terms of personnel and the decisions he needs to make to move quickly to prevent a repeat of history. So that's why they're very scared and they're very worried, and these indictments are a testament to that.
Real quick, before we move to people like McCarthy, I do want to talk about this 50-state idea, because that is now being talked about, right? Removing him off the ballot in certain states. That is one thing. The other thing you mentioned, too, with the Republican convention, you know, some funny business there. What does that say about the Republican Party if we can't trust them, right? I mean, I know there are certain ones that you probably like and I probably like. I am, like you, a big Donald Trump supporter. I don't care what happens. He's my vote. And there's nothing that's going to change that, short of, you know, some actual evidence of him being a murderer, a child molester or something, which we know is not the case, right? So what does that say about the Republican Party, Gavin? I think that's more of an indictment of the Republican Party than anything. How weak they are, how spineless they are, that's what scares the hell out of me.
Yeah, look, I think the Republican Party is full of turncoats and cowards and backstabbers. And I think they absolutely hate the movement that Trump has ushered onto the national stage, this America First movement, this populist movement, this movement that is not necessarily Republican. I mean, it finds its base in the Republican Party. The Republican Party is sort of the mechanism to bring it forward. But a lot of these Republicans are a completely different ideological breed. I mean, we saw that recently in Iowa with the candidate forum, where you had people like Mike Pence saying, you know, domestic affairs, cities burning down, crime, looting, economic destitution, that's not my problem. My priority overseas. So the Republican Party, especially the leadership and the hierarchy of these different institutions and infrastructure of the party, are writ large opposed to Trump and the movement he represents. And more importantly, they're opposed to the people that Trump has brought into the camp, because Trump has actually made the Republican Party effective and competitive. He broke the blue wall in 2016. He was able to bring a new coalition that was able to win national elections again, because the dying coalition of the country club mold of Republicanism was dead. The Chamber of Commerce Republican Party was dead. It was Trump's populism that won us the white working class, that won us the blue collar votes, that broke through traditionally Democrat areas and was able to expand the map in ways that we had not seen since, you know, the 1980s with someone like with Reagan, or even further back with someone like Richard Nixon. So, you know, they hate him because they understand that he can't control him, that he doesn't share their worldview, that he's not a foreign interventionist, that he's not a globalist, that he's not going to heed to corporate interests, to special interests, to the donor class, all the things that makes a typical Republican tick, you know, doing what the donor class says, repeating the same tribal talking points. Exactly, those types. And, you know, this just goes to show that we're fighting a multi-front war. It's not just the left. It's not just the Dems. It's also, you know, these turncoats among us, or supposedly among us, the people in the Beltway. It's really the Uniparty. The Uniparty establishment is really what has been running this country for decades until Trump, and they're united in their hatred and their vitriol and their dedication to destroying his future political chances and the movement as a whole. So, you know, we have to be vigilant on the Republican side. And me personally, I mean, I deal with most of my, you know, political fights are fellow Republicans. And a lot of the people I'm battling with regularly are fellow Republicans, because we can't actually wage an effective campaign against the left or the Dems if our own house is not in order. And it's going to take a while. It's going to take decades. And I talk about this often. You know, the Republican Party and the Democrat Party have gone through changes over time. The Republican Party, you know, it used to be the party of the Rockefellers. Then Goldwater came in. It culminated with the Reagan Revolution, the conservative revolution. You know, that took a few decades. It's going to be the same thing now. We're going to be moving away from the Bushites, from the Paul Ryans, from the Jeb Bushes of the world, that party that dominated the party up until 2016. We're going to be, you know, slowly moving into a more national populist direction. And that takes time, and it's not going to be easy, and it's going to be a slow, you know, slog fest as we slowly win, you know, different state parties and local parties and control over these auxiliary organizations and all the rest. So, you know, it's just part of this ongoing realignment that we're seeing in this country, both within the party and within the country as a whole. And it makes things very messy. It makes things certainly confrontational, but that's just the time we're living in. And if we don't have Republicans who understand the time we're living in, and many of them don't, Ron DeSantis included, we'll never be able to tackle the problems facing our nation and our society.
I was watching Charlie Kirk yesterday on his show in the afternoon on Real America's Voice, and he was talking about, you know, he said, I've talked to donors, I've talked to people in the political space, and they're not getting it, that if we wait until next May, let's say, to get on board with Donald Trump and get the campaign rolling that way as one party, it's too late. We've lost already. And I that really hit home with me, because you don't think about that sometimes when you talk about the primaries and getting on board with everybody. But, I mean, it's already August, right? We have a year and 3 months left until Election Day, 15 months, right? We're getting closer and closer. And the Republican Party, you know, led by people like Mitch McConnell, led by people like McCarthy, led by people like Ronna McDaniel, these people don't get it. To your point, they just don't understand it. And Gavin, I don't know how to get through to them, because if three indictments and almost a fourth indictment don't get through to you, what is it going to take for them to wake up?
Well, they're in a completely different, you know, reality. I mean, and they, you know, probably personally support some of these things, support these indictments. I'm sure Mitch McConnell does, for example. I mean, they want him to be taken out, and they don't really care about the future of the Republican Party. They don't really care about the future of the country. These are the same people that have been part of the decades-long selling out of our nation to globalist interests. They've been part of gutting our nation economically and spiritually. They've been part of destroying the very fabric of our society for the highest, and just doing it for the highest bidder. So, you know, Trump represents a reversion of those trends. Trump represents a pushback, a reaction to all the things that they have been doing and enabling for a generation. So they don't feel anything for him, and they don't care. They're content to be the token opposition. They're content to do the donors' bidding. They're content to watch the country burn. They do not care. That doesn't impact them. I think some of them are maybe, you know, certainly dumb and maybe persuadable, but I think a lot of these people are very Machiavellian in how they operate, and they're DC swamp creatures through and through. And these are the types of people that are effectively, you know, the part of the Uniparty, and they may share the same partisan label with us. They may still be a Republican, quote unquote, but they're certainly not aligned with the America First agenda. They're certainly not trying to make this country great again, and they see the opportunity to finally destroy Donald Trump as a way to destroy his movement. I don't think they're going to be successful in that, regardless of the outcome. I think this movement is here to stay, and I think all of these actions they're doing only vindicate the very existence of that political and ideological movement, of which you and I are both a part of. But, you know, this just goes to show that the Republican Party writ large has a lot of adjusting to do. And a lot of their failings, you know, a lot of the failings, for example, in the midterms that they always paint on Trump, it's really largely due to their inability to embrace Trump and the ideas that he brings to the table. Because without Trump, they don't get those low propensity voters, those unaligned voters, those independent voters, those first-time voters for Trump. They don't change the electorate. Their electorate that they're basing their entire political, you know, future and strategy on is a dwindling demographic in this country. And without Trump on the top of the ticket, or without embracing Trumpism, you know, throughout the party, you know, they're going to continue to become a regional token opposition, and the Dems are going to turn this into a one-party country like they've done in many states like New York and California and all the rest.
I'd be remiss if I didn't mention, too, this is the same week, by the way, on the third indictment that Hunter Biden's business partner is on Capitol Hill talking about, you know, what's going on and what happened over the last decade or so. Joe Biden claims that he had never talked to Hunter about business. We all knew that was crap. And what do we find out? He did it over 20 times, right? And I've said this, Gavin, on our radio show and on our podcast this week, and I'm going to say it again. But this, to me, is hilarious because as a parent, I'm a new parent. If when my child is older and they end up, let's say, bringing random people to my house or bringing random people on phone calls with me, maybe that don't speak English even, I may say, what's going on here? Why are you talking to these people? And then on top of that, if my child, God forbid, I'm knocking on wood, hopefully not, is a drug addict sleazeball, I'm going to question it even more, right? And Joe Biden didn't do that ever. So this idea that, like, we should just think that, oh, Joe didn't know any better, oh, he's just talking about the weather, it is the ultimate slap in the face to Americans that in the same week they're indicting Donald Trump for not once, not twice, but a third time, we're listening and hearing real time. By the way, it doesn't even include the laptop that we know about, that all this is going on with the Biden family and the media can't talk one freaking second about it.
Yeah, look, I think this is another fantastic point. Every time there's a major bombshell dropped about the Biden crime family, Jack Smith conjures up another indictment. I mean, the timing is certainly suspicious, and it's all designed, obviously all the reasons we've already stated, but another reason they're doing this is to distract from the criminality that's pervasive in the Biden administration, the Biden family, and all these other Democrats that are affiliated with him. So, every time this indictment comes, you know, the media will, talk it up a storm and talk about how Trump's going to jail and Trump's done and Trump's this criminal thug and all these other horrible things. At the end of the day, he hasn't been convicted of anything. He's certainly not guilty of any real crime if you really look at this and you push back all the legalese and nonsense that it's buried in. But the reality is that the Biden crime family is selling access and, you know, selling, you know, privileges and basically selling the government, both when he was vice president under Obama and now today, to whoever, you know, whatever foreign actor or agent is willing to cough up the big bucks. And, Biden is part of that. There's no disputing that anymore. And Hunter Biden was certainly part of that, along with a whole litany of other crimes, from drug crimes to prostitution to you name it. So they are just trying to deflect, to self-project, and to cover up everything that they themselves are guilty of and put it onto Trump. And again, this just goes to show that, none of this would be necessary if they were truly winning. I mean, they're certainly concerned. Mm-hmm. They're certainly scared. Their ability to control the media narrative has been, you know, becoming weaker and weaker. You know, they can't just get Twitter to shut down a story like they did last election cycle. So that's something, you know, positive here for a change. But at the same time, they're resorting to more desperate and, odious, you know, methods to conceal their own crimes and punish their opponents. In this case, that opponent is Donald J. Trump.
Lastly, before we get to you and what you're doing a little bit, let's talk about the 2024 race. I'm going to take out the Democratic side because it looks like they're going to push Joe Biden unless, you know, somehow Michelle Obama runs in there somehow. But they're silencing RFK Jr. the same way they're trying to silence Trump. So I feel bad for him because I actually think I don't agree with him on everything. He is obviously a far better option than Joe Biden. So I'm going to save that for a minute. But let's go to the Republican side. You, I know, are on Twitter quite a bit battling some of the DeSantis folks. I've had my run-ins with a few of them myself. Donald Trump, to me, is and it's not just to me, to polls as well, is a 50 to 60 point favorite at this point, and the indictment's only going to make it get even worse for other candidates. But I do like Vivek Ramaswamy a little bit. I like some of the things he's doing. I like that he's not alienating Trump voters. DeSantis is very interesting to me. I didn't dislike DeSantis, Gavin. You may know more or think more than I do on that, but you know, my father has a house in Florida. You know, I think he's done some nice things down there. I don't get where they're going with their influencers, though, and I'm saying that, you and I being two young guys, it doesn't make sense. They're calling us. Jenna Ellis called me a leftist on Twitter recently because I vote for Donald Trump. Not sure how that works, but that's what they were going with. Also, you can't be a gay rights supporter. You're an anti-conservative, she told me. I don't know what they're doing, Gavin. It's 2023. They're really not with the times, it feels like. Can you give some insight what you think him and his campaign are doing? Because it's not making sense.
Well, listen, you brought up a few things here. One, yeah, listen, I think Vivek has been playing his cards better. I don't fully trust him. I don't necessarily, you know, love everything about him or his background. But I think, you know, you could give some credence to the fact that he's learned and changed his tune over time and adapted his political views. That's fine. That's acceptable. That's legitimate. And I think overall, he's not beholden to the donor class in the same way DeSantis is. So he's able to operate a bit more effectively in this primary. I mean, you know, changing gears to DeSantis, who was, you know, talked about as like, you know, the next Trump, the Trump without Trump, you know, Trumpism without Trump. That was how they pitched him. And, you know, there were polls, you know, going back to December where things were a little bit closer. And that's when everyone jumped ship and you know, Brutist or backstabbed Trump, like they did, you know, Brutus to Caesar on the Senate floor. Everyone was hoping it was the end of Trump, and it wasn't. And it just shows that they continue to underestimate him as a political force and political figure. But what are we seeing with DeSantis? We're seeing a candidate who is largely, as Trump said, driven by his PR and driven by his PR team. And that fundamentally, if you look at the basis of his campaign and the basis of who he is as a candidate, he's extremely weak. He's inarticulate. He's not charming. He's horrible at retail politics. He can't relate to voters. And all he knows how to do is litigate the past and litigate COVID. And he's just been flailing left and right. He's been making tons of unforced errors. He had some of the worst people in the business hired. They weren't prepared for the national stage. They weren't prepared for the big leagues. He's brought on some of the worst influencers who are honestly turned off a ton of people. Yep. That I know and others have known. And his polling is only cratered. And they've constantly set up new, you know, new goalposts. They can't move them fast enough. You know, first, oh, he wasn't a candidate. He's not running. Then it's like, oh, wait till he announces. Then he announces. And then it's like, oh, well, the indictment is just, you know, it's just a temporary boost for Trump. Then 2-3 months later, it's like, well, you know, we hope Trump goes to jail, because that's really what it comes down to now. They're hoping that the DOJ takes out Trump, because that's the only path he has going forward. And this is the same stuff that the donor class and the elites that have been destroying the Republican Party and they've been destroying the country were telling him, were feeding him, and he was arrogant enough and stupid enough to believe it. And now he's stuck. And if you look at his body language, you look at how he operates in interviews, he looks like a scared guy. He looks like a guy who doesn't have a lot of confidence in himself or his campaign. And, you know, they're burning through cash left, right, and center of their campaign. You know, the PAC still has a good amount of money, but the campaign, you know, what, did they just fire 30-something people? You know, he's getting destroyed, and the more people are exposed to him, the weaker and weaker he gets. And you get these influencers, people like Jenna Ellis, who, you know, people like me used to be friends with this woman. You know, I was very friendly with her when she was a pro-Trump person, you know, and she just started coming out of nowhere to attack me like she attacked you. She initiates these fights regularly, and then when you push back on them and when you defend them, when you defend yourself, she'll say, oh, he's a misogynist. Yep. Or he's anti-woman. I mean, you know, the only people that are acting like leftists are not people like you and I for voting for Trump. It's people like Jenna Ellis and all the rest of these DeSantis influencers who are becoming indistinguishable, both from the Never Trumpers in 2016 and from the Never Trump left. They're repeating the same lines, they're regurgitating the same talking points, the same lines of attacks, and it's pathetic. It's absolutely pathetic to see this happen, and they've lost all their credibility, and they've done it all for a guy who's now lingering in the low to mid-teens in the primary poll. I mean, you know, my dog, who's sleeping right on the floor next to me, is closer to Donald Trump in the polling than Ron DeSantis, or is just as close to Trump in the polling as Ron DeSantis is. I mean, it's ridiculous. So, you know, at the end of the day, he's going to lose. His political future is over. He could have waited. He could have played his cards right. But I think he showed himself for the kind of person he truly is. He has no loyalty. Certainly no loyalty to Trump or the Trump voters, who basically, you know, kept his political career alive. He went from being largely a backbencher member of Congress to almost losing to a meth head before Trump got involved. And now he clearly is not prepared for the national scene. Yeah, he's an okay governor of Florida, but he can't expand beyond Florida. And, you know, it doesn't matter how much they build him up or how much astroturfed, donor-funded, you know, support he gets, he exists in a bubble. He exists largely in an online bubble, and Trump continues to be the de facto leader of the Republican Party and the best shot, based on the polling, to take back the White House. And their gaslighting techniques of saying Trump is not electable is not backed by anything quantifiable. It's just backed by them, you know, projecting it into the ether.
And I'm going to say that, too, before I get to you in a second. You said it perfectly. The Trumpism without the Trump. That what the left and conservatives don't understand is that's what is lovable about Trump, the Trump part, right? I mean, that's what we all love, right? We love the honesty. Right. We love the never backing down from anybody. That's what we love about him, right? And you're not going to take that from us. One thing that drives me nuts, I'm going to bring up Mike Pence for 5 seconds here, is when that guy's on a debate stage or when that guy's talking to Tucker Carlson or even through his Twitter, he is the politician that all of us can't stand. I don't want to hear the politician voice of, like, let me tell you what the fist, let me tell you what I don't want to hear that crap. I just don't want to hear it. Yeah. Like, enough of that shit. Give me what I want, which is a guy that shoots it straight. To your point about Ramaswamy, I don't love some of the things he said in the past, but in the past too, but I do respect that he's not bought and sold and he can say what he wants to say. Ron DeSantis.
Right. That's why.
Go ahead.
And that's why people like RFK Jr. on the Dem side, and he's, you know, a cult following. I mean, I wish you mentioned him earlier. I wish he had more support. Again, I don't agree with everything he has to say, but he's better on some positions than many of these mainline establishment Republicans. And I've said this repeatedly. You know, back in the day, you need to have a voice for radio. Then you needed to have a face for television. Yeah. Now you need to be authentic, because authenticity is what shows on things like social media, and it shows in things like podcasts and all this other media. Someone like RFK has it, Trump has it, and all these people regurgitating this really trite line about, oh, well, we like Trump, we don't like the mean tweets or the Trumpism or all his baggage. That's nonsense. What people actually loved about him is that he just spoke his mind. He spoke off the cuff, and he wasn't, you know, this consultant approved group tested candidate, which is exactly what Ron DeSantis is. Ron DeSantis doesn't do or say anything without 20 different consultants approving it, without running it by 10 pollsters and, you know, 15 focus groups. That's the candidate Ron DeSantis is, and it makes him basically a brick, and he's not dynamic on the stump. He's not dynamic in this campaign because he's so, you know, wedded and weighed down by all of his different, you know, not just the consultants, but what he has to do for his different constituents and it's the donor class and his corporate backers and all the rest. Trump could just be Trump. Trump could just speak from the heart. And that's why he has, what, over 85% or something small dollar donors. Mm-hmm. The people are the ones that love Trump. The people are the ones that are backing Trump. And they have no problem giving money, for example, to help him fund his legal defense against these unconstitutional, politicized prosecutions and indictments, which would destroy the very fabric of our country. I'm glad people are donating to help Trump fight back against that. That's a good thing. It's a lot more beneficial than wasting your money on Ron DeSantis. I'm actually going to tweet about this right after the show. And all the lines of attack they've thrown against Trump have fallen flat. Every line of attack, whether it's COVID, whether it's, you know, supposedly embracing Fauci, you know, or just being bad at his job. I mean, they're just trying to rewrite history. We had 4 years of one of the best Republican presidencies in 100 years, in a generation, under all sorts of duress and extraneous circumstances that no other Republican or Democrat have ever faced, and he was still able to accomplish massively on both the domestic front and on the foreign front, and they're trying to rewrite history, and this is a complete 180 from where they were back in December, where they were like, oh, we love Trump. Trump was great, but, you know, he failed in a few places, and now it's time to pass the baton. Now what are they saying? Now they're saying, no, Trump is a criminal. He needs to go to jail. Everything Trump did sucked, and, you know, we're hoping that, you know, the DOJ prosecutes him. That's really where we're at right now, and it's disgusting and shameful.
And I'll say this last thing, too. On the DeSantis, to me, I saw that video last week when he's talking to the little kid about the icy. Like, that just summed up Ron DeSantis, right? Like, what's that, an icy? Oh, there's a lot of sugar in that. Like, come on, man. That's not what a kid wants to hear. You're just a strange, strange dude. And I don't know, Gavin, you're at 30 seconds here. I'll give you the final thought on the 30 seconds here. But debates, people are like, you know, should Trump go to the debate or not? With how much he's up, I almost think it's better to wait this one out. But I also don't think that Ron DeSantis could shine Donald Trump's shoes on a debate stage. He'll eat him alive.
Right. I think Trump would eat him alive. I mean, look, I would love for in a very selfish way, to see Donald Trump on the debate stage, because it would be fun, it'd be entertaining, and it was some of the best moments in 2016. And I do believe, like you believe, that he would wipe the floor with his challengers. So that's no question about it. But ultimately, he doesn't need to. It would do nothing for him. He's at the top of the ticket right now. He's dominating, and this would just give airtime to his opponents. And also, really, the best case against it, frankly, is who's organizing these debates. Sure. You know, YAF, which has, you know, tight connections to Mike Pence, Fox News, whoever. These debates are being pushed and organized by some of these very anti-Trump institutions and individuals. So he would be walking into the hornet's nest. I'm not saying he can't handle that, but at this stage where he is politically, he doesn't need to expose himself to that. And right now, he's pivoting to the general election. We saw this massive rally in Erie, Pennsylvania, where he filled out an arena. No one on the Republican side is doing that. Certainly not Joe Biden on the Dem side. This is a purple county in a purple state in a must-win state. It really doesn't have a lot of bearing on the primary. He's totally pivoted right now to the general election, as he should. This race is over in the primary. All DeSantis and the others are doing are hoping that he gets indicted he has been indicted, hoping he gets sent to jail and knocked off the ballot, and they're hoping to just divide the party and weaken it, only helping the Democrats. And it's shameful what they're doing, and every day that this goes on, they're destroying their political futures. People like DeSantis more than others. The rest of them are just running for cabinet spots or whatever.
The left told us, though, that arena was only less than 50% full, so don't forget that, Gavin. There was nobody at that rally. Real quick, right. Tell us a little bit about you. Tell us a little bit about New York Young Republicans Club and how people can find you.
Absolutely. Well, the New York Young Republican Club is the oldest and largest young Republican club in the country. We go back to the founding of the Republican Party in 1856. We've been an institution here in New York, for over a century. We do, everything from speaker events to socials to rallies to protests, you name it, to, knocking on doors to getting Republicans elected. So we're a fully, fledged political organization, all volunteer run here in the belly of the beast that is New York City. We're fighting the good fight behind enemy lines. We're a pro-Trump organization. We're pro, populism. We're pro-conservatism. And we're really, part of this new movement in terms of an organization that's trying to rebrand and rebuild the Republican Party in the image of Trump, in the image of Trumpism and all that he represents. So, you can find out more about us at our website, nyyrc.com. You can follow us on social at nyyrc. And we have tons of great events. We have a gala at the end of this year, 111th annual gala. It's a 500-600-700 person black tie affair here in New York City. We've been doing that continuously since 1911. Happy to run it. I run it on the side. It's not my full-time job, but we've certainly made a lot of headlines over the years. One of the first organizations to endorse Trump this cycle, and we're going to continue to fight the good fight, even in deep blue New York, because it's still worth fighting for.
How do people find you personally?
You could follow me at Gavin Wax. That's on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, you name it. My website, gavinwax.com, has all my columns and op-eds. I write a regular column for either the Daily Call or Town Hall or Newsmax that you could check out. And I have a book coming up with my co-author, Troy Olson, called The Emerging Populist Majority, which talks about a lot of the things we touched on in today's show, the realignment populist politics, reshaping the Republican Party and the future of American politics over the next few decades. So that'll be coming out hopefully at the end of the year, beginning of next year.
Awesome. I will make sure we tell our listeners when that's coming out to go get that book. Gavin, thank you so much for spending about 40 minutes with us today. Excuse me. I appreciate that.
No, this was great. I'm glad to be on whenever you need me, and I'm glad we finally got to connect here, and it was a great discussion.
Awesome. Again, folks, see us throughout the week, 833-FIN-GUYS for all of our podcasts and our morning show, financialguysmedia.com. I will see you next Thursday. USA.
Ladies and gentlemen, distinguished guests, and my fellow citizens, America's comeback starts right now.
Any rebroadcast, reproduction, or other use of this show without the express written consent of the Financial Guys LLC is strictly prohibited.